You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Dana Perkins, and you're listening to Switched On, the BNEF podcast. Draft guidance for the U.S. Hydrogen Production Tax Credit was introduced in December of 2023 with the aim of promoting decarbonization in hard-to-abate sectors and enhancing energy security in the country as well. The draft guidance requires electrolysis projects to meet additional criteria, including hourly matching between clean energy production and power consumption. While some applaud the draft guidance for preventing greenwashing and driving real decarbonization, others view these requirements as excessive and fear they could potentially discourage investment in green hydrogen production. On today's show, we bring you a discussion from BNEF's recent summit in New York, where Martin Tengler, who leads BNEF's hydrogen research, spoke with Kathleen Barron, Executive Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer at Constellation, alongside Claire Bihar, Chief Commercial Officer at Hystor Energy, and Elena Scaltriti, Chief Commercial Officer at Topsoe, and lastly, Andy Veazey, President and Chief Executive Officer at Fortescue North America. During their lively discussion of the 45V tax credit, they considered whether a heavy focus on green hydrogen production overlooks hydrogen adoption, and they compared the U.S. to Europe, where you do see demand-side incentives. As they consider what it will take to build out a hydrogen industry in the United States, they got into which technologies are going to help them get there and the associated costs. Agendas and videos from previous BNEF summits, including this one, can be found at bnef.com under the Events tab. As always, if you like this podcast, make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and consider giving us a review to make us more discoverable by others. Right now, though, let's hear Martin's panel from the BNEF Summit in New York, titled Controversial Shifts in America's Green Hydrogen Landscape.
Let's jump straight in. So when President Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act in August 2022, many in the hydrogen industry saw it as a turning point, as a real game changer, a $3 per kilogram tax credit for anybody who can make hydrogen with very, very low carbon emissions. But almost 2 years later, no one has actually received a single dollar because we're waiting for guidance on how these credits can be claimed. In December, the Treasury and the IRS published a draft of this guidance, and this draft is quite controversial for including the so-called three pillars of additionality, time matching, and deliverability. Most companies want leniency on these three pillars, but some are in favor. Billions of dollars are at stake in this debate. And everybody agrees on one thing: we need final rules as soon as possible. And this is where we get to our panelists. Claire, you've become quite famous recently for coming out in favor of these really strict rules. So I'm going to quote your recent testimony at a public hearing on March the 25th, where you said, Hystor Energy urges the Treasury and the IRS to adopt the three pillars approach, requiring additionality from day one, strong deliverability standards, and a phase-in of hourly matching by 2028. First, can you explain to us what these three pillars are so we educate the audience? And second, what makes it possible for you to argue in favor of these three pillars when some of our other panelists and most of the industry seem to be in favor of some leniency?
Perfect. Thank you, Martin, and thank you, BNEF, for the opportunity to speak today. I'll start with defining what the three pillars are. The three pillars are strict guidelines in relation to the guidelines for grid-connected electrolyzers. And these guidelines are to ensure that there is robust accounting for the carbon emissions associated with grid-connected electrolyzers. And so starting with additionality, it's a requirement that new green electrons are powering the electrolyzers. For regionality, this is to ensure that the clean hydrogen production is in the same location as the clean electricity that's powering them. And this is to ensure that you're not claiming green electrons in West Texas, for example, are then correlating to your project, your hydrogen project in New York. And then lastly is time matching. That's to ensure that the clean electricity is being produced at the same time as the green hydrogen production. So the guidelines have a transition period similar to that of the EU that allow for an annual matching for until 2028. And then from then on, it's an hourly matching. And the reason why these three pillars are so important, it's to ensure that we're investing in long-term infrastructure that are decreasing emissions instead of, in fact, increasing emissions. And unfortunately, today, our electric grid is still predominantly fossil fuel-based, 60, 70, as high as 80% in some locations. And so if you are putting on a large load and you're not then adding more renewable electricity such as wind or solar, you are in fact increasing the demand for fossil fuels. That would be backfilled by peakers that are coal and natural gas. And so High Store Energy, you know, really applauds the Treasury for taking this stance and ensuring that the three pillars are upheld. And from our perspective, our project prior to the guidelines is going to be three-pillar compliant from day one. And our first project is the Mississippi Clean Hydrogen Hub, which couples on-site, off-grid, dedicated renewables for our electrolysis production and salt cavern storage co-located. And storage gives us the ability to store excess hydrogen, and then it is dispatchable on demand four times when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. And, you know, holistically, we're in this business to decarbonize. And it's not about just having another molecule. We say if you're gonna burn natural gas, burn natural gas. Don't go through all the loops in order to get there.
So it's a combination of those off-grid renewables as opposed to on-grid, which I think that's relatively easy to understand. You manage to save some costs by not paying for some of the expensive grid fees. And then that salt cavern storage, right? And the salt caverns, is, to me, that's a really, really key factor of the projects that you're building. And salt caverns are quite rare, right? You don't get to build salt caverns just anywhere. I don't think you could build a salt cavern in New York because we're not sitting on a salt deposit right now. So would you consider building projects if you didn't have salt caverns?
Well, so the salt cavern storage is really key for both the scale and the duration. It's that long duration, that multi-day, multi-week, and seasonal energy storage that we're prioritizing in the offtake markets we're looking at, which are the energy-intensive industries where direct electrification is not a viable option. And it's these offtake markets, for example, steel, that are the first movers that are already there with their customers showing the green premium that they want a zero carbon solution. And from the commercial point of view, you know, this transparency in carbon emissions is exactly what our customers are asking for to ensure that they can account for their scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions. And most importantly, that the products they're producing today in the United States with clean hydrogen is competitive and accepted on a global scale.
Okay, so customers want it. One final one before we get to Andy, who I'm sure has very different view on this. So would your position be different, Claire, if your project was not based on top of salt caverns? Would you be also asking for some leniency there?
No, because leniency, with the market in such infancy, there is urgency, but we cannot be sacrificing urgency with investing in infrastructure that's going to continue to lock in fossil fuels. The goal is decarbonization and to transition off of fossil fuels. And hydrogen is an excellent solution because it provides that molecule that can be stored and transported over long distances. And we need to be prioritizing it in the areas of the economy where direct electrification is not a viable option, and not trying to have it spread thin, wide and thin. It needs to be concentrated.
Okay, good to know. So no leniency even if you don't have salt caverns. Okay, I wonder what Andy has to say, because Andy, you are one of the strongest voices asking for those more lenient rules. In your testimony, in that same hearing where Claire was speaking in March, you said, I'm quoting, 45V in its current form is a straitjacket on the emerging industry. The only solution is to, at a minimum, include grandfathering first mover projects. First, can you explain what grandfathering means? And then second, why do you feel this way if Claire says that she can make her projects work even with those strict rules?
Yeah, sure. And first of all, let me say that I hope everybody sitting on this panel is wildly successful.
Because we need that.
We need very low carbon hydrogen, right? We need it as soon as possible, but we need it to have it at the lowest possible cost, right? I think there's a lot in here to unpack. And, you know, and I think we've talked before, and I said that, you know, where you stand on this issue starts with where you sit, right? And if I was sitting in a similar position, then I could basically say, yep, I'm supportive of these things because I know why 75% of the industry can't compete with me because I can't do it, and it's all price. So I think that's great, but here's the deal. We're not doing projects here. We're trying to build an industry. We're trying to build an industry. And the key in building the industry is driving the cost of every molecule down. I always get challenged, well, nobody wants to buy green hydrogen. No, nobody wants to pay the price. But if I could sell that green molecule at the same price as gray, everybody would buy green hydrogen. We'd all be happy as heck, right? So how do you get there? Well, the Biden administration in the Inflation Reduction Act anticipated driving the cost of that molecule down by 2030 to $1 a kilogram. And this was really to incent and get this started, right? And why is it so important that we have as many projects going now, including the early ones that don't meet the three pillars, or one of the three pillars, because almost all of them can meet one, which is deliverability. I can't find too many that don't, right? Well, why is it so important? Because the more you do, the more projects that go, the ones that are successful, the ones that fail, you're building economies of scale, economies of manufacture to bring down your costs, and economies of knowledge to get smarter about how to do it. You gotta drive that engine to be successful. And here's the deal. If we made the same requirements for this industry to have to bring its own green electrons to the party, and we made that apply to everybody who was making electric vehicles, I would not be driving my electric vehicle today. Why this one, right? And here's the other issue. We're trying to solve too many problems with one piece of rulemaking, right? There are 2.6 terawatts of renewables standing in queues. That's twice the installed total capacity. Now we're going to require even more pressure to push through that. How is this industry going to start? Yes, I'm very happy that Hystar is going to have a project. I really am. But that's not going to build an industry. You have to open and broaden that aperture, right? And then it will close over time. We're not advocating that people don't pay attention to the three pillars, because they are critically important, right? You said it. We have no totally green grids, right? We have none, right? The other thing we don't have is we don't have enough green electrons. We have to sort that in time, but we're saying that for projects that can get into construction by 2028, they should be grandfathered so we get them going, right? And one other issue, which no one talks about outside the three pillars, is the CREEP model. So every year you have to reevaluate the credits you get and what they're worth. Who can finance a project that way? So there's a lot of work to be done, but here's the deal. Every effort is good. Let's widen the aperture. Let's not restrict it right off the bat so we have a few projects. Because here's what 45V in its purest form will do. It will make the plant smaller. All right. You can ask me why, but I'm not going to explain now. Smaller. There'll be fewer of them, and they will cost more. Estimates right now is that projects will increase in cost between 140 and 175% to the end consumer. How are you going to build demand? That is ensuring, absolutely ensuring, that high carbon intensity hydrogen comes into this market. So let me stop there.
Andy, I get it. So more expensive hydrogen, fewer projects, smaller projects. So you said your position, you stand where you sit. Why don't you, or why doesn't Fortescue sit on top of salt caverns?
Well, I'll tell you where we do sit. Well, first of all, look, I think you said it right. There are very few. And it's not all salt, it's domal salt. And if you look at a map, there are only so many, right? It's a scarce resource. But if you would ask me where Fortescue sits, it sits on planet Earth.
Yeah, we all do.
Right?
Yeah.
We all do. And therefore, get to decarbonization for with a molecule for people who can't use an electron should be in all our best interest. Widening the aperture, right, doesn't impact I-STOR.
Right.
You call it lenient, or you called it lenient. That's a judgment already. I call it appropriate, right? So let's build an industry here, and let's not try to solve every problem with one piece of rulemaking today when we're really building an industry for the 2030s and 2040s.
Right. Yeah, I call it more lenient, not lenient. Andy, one final for you before we move on to Elena and Kathleen. So both you and Claire, this is really interesting, both you and Claire are members of GH2. Which is one of the strictest hydrogen standards for you have to produce your hydrogen at 1 kilogram of CO2 or less per kilogram of hydrogen that you make. Your CEO, Andrew Forrest, is on the board of the GH2 organization. So isn't your dislike of the hourly matching pillar at odds with your membership of the GH2?
No, I don't think so, because it doesn't actually specify hourly matching, monthly matching, or annually matching. What it does require is we follow the rules and laws that are in place. That it does. I think for Fortescue, we have an absolute commitment that we will never leave anything worse off than when we come, whether it's a water aquifer, the community in terms of what we're doing, or that we will directly impact and higher emissions of CO2. We have a project in Washington State. In Washington State, they manage that. Mm-hmm. In Washington State, it's hydropower. Yeah. In Washington State, that project would not meet this requirement. And it's a perfectly good project. This is what we have to sort out. There are a few pieces in conflict here, but what's not in conflict for anybody on this stage is the urgency by which we have to produce those very low carbon intensity molecules. So let's get at it. Let's make it so people can come to this game and we can learn, we can build, we can manufacture. And here's the other piece of it. If we're increasing the cost of these projects, what's a project developer going to do? You're going to buy the cheapest electrolyzers you can. You know where they're made?
China.
And the whole purpose of this bill was to build infrastructure in this country.
Right? We have a report on electrolyzers in China. They're not going to have it as easy as it seems. Even
all right, but let me tell you, they'll have it easier when everybody's buying them because they have to get those costs down here to manage the cost of that molecule. All right? And here's the other thing. Fortescue is a large public company in Australia. We're in 30 different countries. And I have to go before Andrew Forrest and tell him why I think he should put a dollar of his money here versus Morocco, versus Egypt, versus Norway, right? So think about where capital's going to go, where the capital flows are going to go. And one other aspect of this, and the Inflation Reduction Act, was the creation of an industry having capital invested here. So these are the things why we're concerned about and why we might have a slightly different view on this than high students.
Good to know that your membership of the GH2 standard is not at odds with your arguments for leniency or more leniency on these rules. Moving on to Elena. So, Elena, many green hydrogen proponents say that the proposed guidance, the strict guidance, benefits blue hydrogen by being too strict on green and therefore constraining green hydrogen and making blue the default technology to go to.
And your company, Topsoe, licenses a blue hydrogen technology called Syncor to firms like Exxon and Fidelis. But your client Exxon is now threatening to ditch a blue hydrogen project that would use your technology because the rules would make it hard for them to qualify for the clean hydrogen credit, and they would have to settle for a lower credit, the 45Q credit for carbon capture and storage. So what is your view? Does the current guidance on green hydrogen help blue hydrogen by constraining green, or does it hurt blue hydrogen because it doesn't allow them to get those credits?
So thank you, and really pleased to be here. Let me start by saying that at Topsoe we have the beauty of having a number of technologies that actually speak to all colors, and for that we are color agnostic when it comes to hydrogen. So in fact we tend to talk about low carbon hydrogen and renewable hydrogen. And we, when you look at our portfolio of technologies, it's true we have blue with our Syncor, which is a fully commercial and fully scaled technology, but we are making huge investments for our size of company in green with the electrolyzer, the SOEC electrolyzer. So we are really invested in both technologies, mm-hmm. And in many more, because we are as well in renewable fuels. So as a matter of fact, we are quite agnostic. And as Andy said, we are all for decarbonization in whatever form and shape it takes place, as long as it takes place fast enough that we can commit and actually get to our 2050 targets. Mm-hmm. So I think everybody that talks about 45V at the moment is unhappy, whether it's green or blue, so in any shade of color. When we think of green and we think of our own investments and the customers we talk to, there is certainly a concern about availability of feedstocks to actually scale up the technology, test the technology, making sure that it comes, you know, at the right cost in the right amount of time. But also when we speak to our customers in the low carbon hydrogen and low carbon ammonia for that, or blue hydrogen and ammonia, they do have concerns that actually, as it is shaped at the moment, the 45V doesn't really favor decarbonization. Why? Because actually it sets a standard, which is for the calculation of the carbon intensity based on the carbon intensity of the feedstocks, which are based on historical averages. So actually not favoring projects and those project developers that want to be more ambitious, that actually want to make investment towards decarbonizing the whole value chain, methane emissions, and also being more ambitious on the carbon capture on the process of hydrogen production. Hence, actually failing a bit the whole purpose and the philosophy of the IRA and the 45V specifically. So if and we have advised accordingly, we would actually advise changes both with regards to green hydrogen and to low carbon hydrogen. And just with the purpose of doing things quickly enough that you can scale up technology, but that you can also enable and implement technologies that are already fully scaled and commercial and can bring an enormous impact in a relatively short amount of time.
Okay, so Topsoe wins either way, whether it's blue or green or low carbon or renewable.
We're a happy company. No, I always say, I don't know if it's by design or by luck, but we sit right in the middle of the energy transition, and our ambition is actually to make it happen. And it's just good that I think we're quite neutral towards the color that it has to take.
Okay. Do our other panelists have anything to say? Andy, Claire, what do you guys think about the impact of this guidance on blue? Is it good for blue or is it bad for blue?
I think the comment I'll make is, unfortunately, so much attention has been brought to 45V and almost pitting green hydrogen companies against each other, while no attention has been put on 45Q with blue hydrogen. So I think, you know, as Andy said, everyone up here in favor of green, and it is about decarbonization. So I think I'll say that.
Okay. We're all in favor of decarbonization. That's good. So,
if not, we were in the wrong place.
Moving on to another topic, and this is where we bring our last panelist, Kathleen. Kathleen, your company, Constellation, has the biggest nuclear fleet in the U.S., 21 reactors, if I check correctly. Now, the nuclear industry has struggled somewhat economically in the recent past, at least so my colleagues in the power team tell me. So it's not a surprise, of course, that the nuclear industry would like to get some benefits from making hydrogen. But the draft guidance right now excludes most nuclear because of the additionality clause. So if you're 3 years or older, your plant is 3 years or older, then you don't qualify with the current rules. So your CEO, Joe Dominguez, in an interview with Bloomberg, called the additionality rule crazy. So how... That's quoting it. How important is hydrogen? It seems like hydrogen really is very important for the nuclear industry, but how important is it for nuclear industry? Is it a matter of life and death for the nuclear industry? If these credits don't work out, then, we're folding.
So I have to start out by saying not only do we have an expert moderator, but we have a comedian moderator, too. This is the best panel I've ever been on. This is great. Hydrogen is important to nuclear. Nuclear is important to hydrogen. I need to go back to the passage of the bill. This is not like a policy conversation. I am a recovering lawyer, so I have to focus on the fact that the statute is explicit that nuclear can be used to power an electrolyzer and make hydrogen that can qualify for the credit. In fact, we are already making clean hydrogen with nuclear energy at an electrolyzer that we built in New York, right next to one of our plants. The reason we built that is because we got a grant from the Department of Energy to build that electrolyzer. We've also gotten a grant to power one of the 7 hydrogen hubs, the one that is encompassing the Midwest states. Not going to happen if we can't use the nuclear energy to make the hydrogen for that hub. All that work, that's $900 million of investment, that's on pause while we wait for the guidance to come out. So we'll see what happens. When we see the final rules, but you said a moment ago, no one's making hydrogen here. We're making hydrogen here. We're claiming the credit. So, if we have to visit with the courts to sort out whether the final guidance is consistent with the statute or not, we've already had Senator Manchin offer to write an amicus brief. The people who wrote this bill didn't write additionality into it. They knew how to specify when something needed to be built by a certain date. They didn't do that with respect to the electricity going into the electrolyzer. They just said it had to be zero carbon. We make more zero carbon megawatts than anyone in the country. 1 out of every 10 comes out of one of our machines. And so, yes, we are focusing on this as a way to ensure the long-term operation of the nation's nuclear fleet. The Inflation Reduction Act was the first time the federal government provided a credit to existing resources, so the fleet is receiving a credit. But unlike the other credits in the Act, it does expire in 8 years. So if a nuclear reactor were able to sell clean electricity, whether through the grid or directly behind the meter to an electrolyzer, those types of contracts only need to be, you could still claim the credit if you sign one of those contracts early in the 2030s, and it's in place for 10 years. So it's a long-term potential revenue stream to provide the reactor a reason to stay on the grid past the expiration of the 45U credit.
Okay, so this is a long-term mechanism for nuclear to live, and I'm glad you mentioned the other credit because that was going to be my next question. Because the nuclear industry is getting its own 45U credit for nuclear power plants. So do I understand it correctly that the 45U, in your view, is not giving you enough of a long enough supply of money, and then you would need for the longer term to be producing the hydrogen?
Yeah, to be clear, 45U is designed to ensure that a reactor can recover its cost of operations if market prices are below its cost of operations. So unlike credits for wind and solar, the 45U credit actually phases down as market prices go up. It has that built-in consumer protection feature. But the point is it expires in 8 years. So unlike the renewable credits, which will be in place till all of your children are, you know, grown and have their own kids, this credit will not be. So it is a potential revenue source. You know, all the points we've made here about demand are accurate. We need to have a market for this commodity, and therefore we need to get going at bringing down the cost, as we've done with other types of technology, so that it can be a long-term source of revenue. But, you know, we're sort of stuck in the starting blocks here. And, you know, this notion of additionality, just, we struggle with it just economically. I mean, if the logic is that wind farm or solar farm wouldn't be there but for the hydrogen credit, I struggle with that, because I know all of you who woke up this morning and say, gee, I wish we had more wind and solar on the grid. You don't think, well, geez, if only we had more hydrogen, you know, subsidies. It's, we don't have an interconnection queue that works. We need wind and we need zoning and permitting to improve. We need a better supply chain. We need the skilled workforce. We have demand for new renewables. They are not coming on the grid because of hydrogen. So if you're using renewables to make hydrogen, you are cannibalizing the grid when you use new resources, same way as the argument goes, you do so if you're using an existing resource. So we need to build more clean. We need to get to a clean grid. We're trying to do too much with this credit. Well, you know, the courts don't usually love it when agencies that aren't, you know, experts in something try to manage it. So I fear that's where this is going if we don't have some more rationality in the final rule.
Okay. So we learned about the importance of the hydrogen credit to the nuclear industry. Now, what I'm interested in is the other way around. What's the importance of the nuclear industry to the hydrogen industry? And Claire, I think you in particular actually said in that March testimony that you would actually favor exceptions from additionality for nuclear power plants. Could you explain the reasoning behind that?
Yeah. And I think you brought up the point, which is if it is making it so that an asset is not going into retirement, then this is a firm baseload zero carbon source. And whereas if you are not adding new renewables to a grid, from our view, that is cannibalizing. We're adding massive demand by plugging an electrolyzer into a grid, and we are not adding more zero carbon assets to that grid. What's going to happen in turn is that's going to fuel more fossil fuel generation to then feed that load. So we need to be creating a decarbonized grid, but also a more resilient grid.
And nuclear additionality exceptions help that.
Sorry?
And exceptions for nuclear from additionality help
that. If it keeps, yes, and if it keeps that asset from going into retirement.
Okay. Kathleen, sorry, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the Treasury suggested as much in the proposed rule. So we'll see what that translates into in terms of flexibility in the final rule. What we've said is, you know, if you're causing a station to seek a second license renewal, In other words, approval from the government to run for another 20 years, and that is sort of in the same time vicinity as the contract with the hydrogen customer, that should qualify. There's also a suggestion that there be some, you know, potential phase-in, or, you know, if you look at what the EIA says, not what we say, but the EIA says about what will happen when this 45U credit expires, we will see nuclear retirements. They estimate that's 20% of the fleet, so you get up a 20% exemption, something like that, 10%, those are all in the mix. But your question was, is nuclear important to hydrogen? And
yes.
I think that is true, because, and it's why it was explicit in the statute that existing nuclear can make hydrogen, is because it is operating 24/7. And that is the way to get the most efficiency out of your electrolyzer, to have a constant source of power at the power quality that you need that runs 95% of the time. So it's, you know, you don't want to take the cheapest option off the table right out of the bat. And that's essentially what we've done with this guidance.
Andy.
Yeah, so we also publicly commented and put into our testimony exemptions for nuclear. We may never use nuclear electrons. We may, but right now we don't, and we don't have any intention to. But we think it's important because it goes back to my initial argument. I hope they have electrolyzers, really big ones, at every nuclear plant they have. Why? Because then someone has to produce more electrolyzers. The more you produce, economies of manufacture, the price goes down. Somebody invests in advanced membrane technology. Everything that pulls and creates demand for all the bits and pieces that make it is good for the entire industry. Right? Am I finished? I have one more. I don't buy into blue. Why? Because I don't think the future to a decarbonized world is the pathway has methane underneath it. But at this point, I'm not arguing with it because, again, I want everybody to be successful. And at the end of the day, the market's going to decide what they want to buy, right? And that's another piece to the incrementality thing. The idea that we should have tax policy allocating a scarce resource to me is nuts. Right? Because I go back to my argument. Why is this the only industry that has to bring their own? Everybody who wants to buy it should be asked to do the same thing. And then what you do, you have a market because we'll compete. My view is if I can buy a green electron and I can pay the price for it, that must be the highest value for it. Otherwise, somebody would ask to pay more. Let markets decide. But the bottom line here, we're getting overly focused on these little bits and pieces of policy, of tax policy and rulemaking when we're trying to build an industry. Remember the administration's goal, $1 a kilogram by 2030. There is nothing in this rulemaking, proposed rulemaking, that will get us there.
Yeah. So that actually leads us to the final part of this discussion. I think it's fitting that we have only 9 out of 40 minutes left and we're talking about the most important topic, because that's how it seems to work throughout the whole discussion around hydrogen, which is demand for hydrogen. So my team believes at BNEF that the world and the U.S. needs demand-side incentives. So for somebody to actually want to buy the hydrogen that you guys produce. But the tax credits, which we just spent 30 minutes talking about, they are worth $100 billion, and they're all for the producers. And the U.S. does have a demand-side incentive being developed right now, but that's a $1 billion incentive. So we're talking 1 to 100 ratio, possibly, for the demand side. Which is very different from Europe, Elena, right? Europe has the subsidies, it has the carbon prices, it has the quotas and the mandates. So lots of demand-side incentives going on over there. So as someone who just came to us from Europe, should the U.S. be doing more on supporting the demand side or incentivizing the demand side in order to get the industry going, creating an industry like Andy's saying?
Yeah. So first of all, coming from the European perspective, everybody in Europe has been talking about the IRA as a game changer. And it's actually, you know, an initiative that has drawn a lot of, investments towards the U.S. And I think it's a great initiative, and it's really trying to move the needle. Now, I come from Europe. I'm based in Copenhagen, and Europe is, I think, the best in class for mandates. So for the famous stick, we are very good at that. Now, and we also have subsidies, but, you know, it's much more complex to get subsidies in Europe than to get tax credit through the IRA. And we do as well have some experience because we are looking at a U.S. site for our electrolyzer production as we speak. And we realize that, you know, the tremendous difference in complexity in going through this discussion. But back to your question. I mean, when we talk to our customers in the U.S., and we have a very broad pipeline of projects here in the region, driven by the IRA, and they really blossomed as soon as the IRA was published, it's two things. It's certainty for the incentives, clarity and long-term sustainability of the incentives, and the other side, because it's tax credit and it's when you produce, is that you have a demand. And the demand at the moment is not clear at all. And actually, there's no driver in the U.S., in North America, that would, you know, really incentivize demand. And as you say, the $1 billion taken from the hydrogen hub, it's a good idea, but it's a very tiny thing. So actually, U.S. and the future U.S. producers would be looking at Europe or at Northeast Asia, Japan and Korea, to actually export. And I think, you know, if we want to make this successful, it's great that Europe is doing this and, you know, it will drive demand. It will impose a competitive issue on the European producers. But U.S. should also think about how to really deploy demand to make this a success.
Thank you to our panelists. I think it's clear that the 45V credit is a very, very hot debate. I think no matter how it's going to pan out, the U.S. is going to become a leader on low-carbon hydrogen, and it's clear that our panelists' companies are going to be at the forefront of it all. So thank you very much. Thank you to our panelists. And
thank you.
Have a good day, everyone.
Today's episode of Switched On was produced by Cam Gray with production assistance from Kamala Schelling. Bloomberg NEF is a service provided by Bloomberg Finance LP and its affiliates. This recording does not constitute, nor should it be construed as investment advice, investment recommendations, or a recommendation as to an investment or other strategy. Bloomberg NEF should not be considered as information sufficient upon which to base an investment decision. Neither Bloomberg Finance LP nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.